right, we have three cases on our docket today, two of which are on the 9 o'clock docket, so we'll plan on going directly from one to the second one, and then we'll have a short recess and come back and pick up the third case at 10:30. The first case is called Ard versus Hudson, cause number 213-198-CV. If the clerk will please announce counsel, who'll be arguing today.
May it please the court, Mr. Thomas Wright to argue for the appellant, and Mr. George Young to argue for the appellee.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Wright.
Chief Justice Livingston, and may it please the court. My client, Mary T. Ard, has alleged and believes and can prove that her brothers have continuously and intentionally breached their fiduciary duties as executors in the performance of those duties on behalf of their mother's estate. And for that, the Hudsons believe, for making that claim, that she should be disinherited. And apparently the trial judge, the probate court, concluded that because in the spring of 2012, Mary T. Ard filed a motion for appointment of a receiver, a remedy, to preserve the status quo until these claims could be determined, she had violated the interorum clause. Now, if you take the Hudson's argument to its extreme, their argument means that they could buy all of the assets of this estate themselves personally for a dollar, and no one could do anything about it. Certainly no beneficiary without violating the interorum clause. That rule, of course, would be open season for any fiduciary in this district to take anything they wanted where there's an interorum clause in the trust or in the will. You know, the ironic thing about interorum clauses, or forfeiture clauses as they're known, is that if this had been a real will contest, and it's not, but where there is a real will contest, you have to try that first to see if, in fact, the will is valid. In this case, because Mary T. did not challenge the will, but challenged the exercise of the fiduciary duties by her brothers, she has been disinherited by the probate court without there ever being a determination of whether her claims are true. And so in this court, you have to assume her claims are true, that her brothers have commingled funds, that they have taken estate funds that they should not have taken, that they have failed to disclose information to her, and so forth. And so by merely making those claims, even if true, she is disinherited. That cannot be true, and happily, the law of this state is firmly and unanimously against that concept. The Hudsons cannot cite to you one case where a person brought a claim for breach of fiduciary duty that was held to be a violation of a forfeiture clause. And by the way, I want to take a little aside here and talk about the recharacterization of this clause. The Hudsons have come in here in their briefing and in their arguments below and said, this really isn't an interorum clause, it's something else. It's a non-interference clause. Well, there's two problems with their idea about that. The first is this will does not even use the term interference. That's not a term found in the will. But more importantly, the law, the cases that we've been able to discover and cite to this court have very similar provisions about preventing the implementation of any provision, and they are all called interorum clauses or non-interference or forfeit, not non-interference, interorum clauses or forfeiture clauses. In fact, the Supreme Court case of Badow, which we cite in our brief, went right over that. Now, there was a provision in there that said, you know, challenge any part of the will or whatever, or prevent its performance. The Supreme Court called that a no contest clause. So why are they trying to recharacterize this? Well, to get away from the solid body of law that says it's not a violation of this kind of clause if you're trying to hold the fiduciary to their duty. So we have some general principles to be applied in this case. Obviously, you know, you're supposed to give intent to the to the testator's intent, supposed to give effect to the testator's intent. That has a limit in these kind of cases, and this court held that back in, I believe it was 1985, in the Stewart case. In the Stewart case, the nieces were disinherited if certain people were appointed as their guardians after the testator's death. And the trial court, whether it's a probate or a district court, I don't remember, actually appointed that person as the guardians of these people. And this court held that clause to try to restrict the ability of the court as to who they're going to appoint a guardian is void, as against public policy. And for the more normal kinds of interorum clauses, this court and every other court has said two things. One, they are strictly construed to avoid a forfeiture. Avoiding a forfeiture is one of the fundamental principles that you'll find throughout all of these cases. The second thing these cases say is that whatever prohibited conduct that you're trying to prohibit has to be directly and specifically spelled out. And so you have the case where a man set up a trust for his wife to provide for her health care. Apparently she was already in failing health, and provided that if anybody puts her in a nursing home before this trust is exhausted, then you are disinherited. Well, and that's exactly what I believe one of her sons did on a doctor's advice, but put her in a nursing home, and the court said, well, you know, you're disinherited. That's what it says, and, you know, that was very specific. Another specific case is the Hyder case out of Dallas. Interestingly enough, a law school classmate of mine. But he sued the executive.
Which one?
I'm sorry?
Which one?
Well, the third, I believe. It was Elton Hyder III.
Well, there were several lawyers.
Yes, and a very renowned family. But the court held that that Will said you can't sue the executor, and that's exactly what he did. But he did not raise in the trial court a public policy argument that you can't keep me from suing the executor because of fiduciary duties. And the Dallas court said, well, you didn't raise that below, and we're not going to listen to it now. You did exactly what the will said. So what does this will say? Well, this has some general language about you can't institute any will contest or prevent any provision from being carried out in accordance with its terms. Well, what are the terms? The Hudsons want to say they have absolute authority to do whatever they want, but they ignore the will's provisions about their responsibilities. The executors are given the same duties and powers as a trustee. The trustee provisions, and that's in section 5.53(i)(7), refer to the trust code and say the trustees will have the same duties and obligations that are set out in the trust code. But even if this will wasn't so specific about the duties, the law is clear that you cannot make somebody a fiduciary and then relieve them of all fiduciary duties. And the idea that they want to propose here is just as if their mother had said, I give all of my property in fee simple absolute to my two sons. And if they ever want to share anything with their sister, well, then that's all right with me. Well, that's exactly how they've been treating this. They've been operating this estate as part of their company and a part of their family operations now for 12 years. The idea is for an estate to be wound up and closed and distributed, not for it to be operated in perpetuity by the executors. So my client, Mrs. Ard, has not, and there's this condition precedent language at the end of this interorum clause, which is called forfeiture clause, that says the beneficiary shall accept and agree to all provisions in the will. Well, she has done that. She has said that repeatedly. She accepts all provisions of the will. That does not mean that she can't challenge her brothers for breach of their fiduciary duties. So, you know, I was wondering if someone would ask me, why did Judge King do this? And I wish I could answer that. I have no idea. The law is so clear on our side, not only from this court, but from every other court that's considered it. A claim of breach of fiduciary duty, even a claim to remove a trustee or to remove an executor, or to say that this executor is not qualified. Those have all been held by the courts not to be a violation of the interorum clause.
So let me ask one question then, under the Article 7, which is what I believe you're talking about. Did the appellees not contend that Ms. Ard was contesting the validity of the will or just the enforcement of provisions of the will?
Well, they may well have claimed that she was challenging the validity of the will, but she's not. She doesn't ever say the will says this, but it should say that. And that is, somebody could do that. You know, somebody has asked, well, what meaning would that have? How could you contest a term of the will but not the whole will? Well, for example, there's a bequest to a church, and suppose somebody had come in and say, well, you know, that's the wrong church. She must have made a mistake. She went to a different church or whatever, and contest that provision of the will. So you can have a partial contest without, you know, a complete contest. Mary T. did not do any of that. And because, you know, finally, I mean, all of these claims of hers are about breach of fiduciary duty, and the remedies is what they're complaining about. The injunction to prohibit them from breaching their fiduciary duties by continuing to invest estate money in what she considered risky ventures. They come back and say, oh, well, it paid off. Well, okay. So under their theory, they could take the money to Las Vegas, and as long as they won, that would be a prudent investment. Josephine's will provided that Mary T.'s share go into a trust to be administered by a trustee, and so she would at least have some control, or at least would not be under the control of her brothers. But they are treating this as though they are going to be in control of her part of the estate for as long as they can, I suppose for as long as she lives, until now, which when they're trying to completely disinherit her. I hope I've answered your question about that. So, you know, and then there's the good faith provision. I don't think we need to get to the good faith exception, because you don't get there until there is a violation of the interorum clause. But good faith is an exception that is recognized by the case law. This provision that purports to take it out, we believe, and if briefed, is contrary to public policy. It cuts off people's rights for access to the courts and for redress. But you would not even get there until there's a breach. And as I said a few minutes ago, how ironic it is to be assessing whether or not she brought her claim in good faith without knowing whether her claim is true. If it's true that her brothers have breached their duties and owe her money, then doesn't this make all of this discussion a little bit premature? And as I said, I don't think you can do anything other than take what she has alleged as being true. Because she's not been given any sort of a trial, and there's been no summary judgment on the merits of her claims. So, you know, I don't guess I need to recite all of the cases in our briefs, but I say again, the law is clear that you cannot prevent a beneficiary from bringing a claim of breach of fiduciary duty and claim that it's some sort of a breach of this forfeiture clause. I think what the Hudsons are trying to ask this court to do is to overturn nearly 100 years of precedent from the Supreme Court's case and the Calvary case, where in 1932, that said these clauses are strictly construed. She has done nothing to challenge any provision of the will. She has challenged her brother's performance of their duty. She asked and asked and asked in the probate court for relief. She never got any. She began asking in 2005. She never got any. In 2005, she said she's accepting the terms of the will, but challenging the executor's performance, has continued to say that until finally someone said, you've asked too many times and you're out. And we ask that this court reverse this ruling and hold as a matter of law that my client Mary T. R. did not violate the interorum clause. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wright. Mr. Young.
Good morning. May it please the court. Since the focus of this appeal must necessarily be on Josephine Hudson's intent as it was expressed in her will, I'd like to turn to Article 7 and talk about that for just a moment. I know you've read the briefing, I know you've read the clause, but there are a couple of points I want to make about the clause and then I'll move on. We gave a handout to your honors clerks, and I hope you have it in front of you. It's Article 7. First thing is the title, forfeiture. The second thing says that if anyone shall institute or join in a proceeding, so simply filing an action to tie up the executors in a way contrary to what Josephine said they could do, just filing it under this clause would be enough, although she did, Mary T. did more. Then there's the typical contest the validity of the will, capital W will language, and then an or, and then it says, and this is the interference language, or to prevent any provision thereof from being carried out in accordance with its terms. And then there's the parenthetical where Josephine, in her and her lawyer's wisdom, took good faith off the table, said you can't have a good faith excuse if you try to contravene what I've set forth in my estate plan. Now, Josephine's intent is clear in here. This was a very well thought out, deliberate estate plan, and she made it clear, anyone that interferes with her co-executors is disinherited. Now, what did Josephine know? What do we know from the record? Josephine Hudson knew when she, or her lawyers wrote and she signed this will. She knew that the brothers, Ed and Bill, had been running the oil and gas business for decades, the one that her husband had started. She knew the influence that her husband, Julian Ard, had over Mary T., and knew that he had sued every member of his family, including a fight over an estate. Josephine knew that Mary T. was the lone holdout on the family settlement agreement that balanced three out of the four trusts in the late 1980s, yet she cashed the check, and that she knew Mary T. and Julian had separated out in the early 90s Mary T.'s trust for oil and gas assets from the family. She also knew, and this is well documented in the record, about years and years and years of vicious attacks by Julian and Mary T. on her brothers and even on herself. So she took affirmative steps to deal with the circumstances that she saw around her. She gave 2/3 of her estate outright to Bill and Ed. She put them in charge of the estate assets, and including very specifically the oil and gas assets. But as to Mary T.'s portion, she put that in trust with an institutional trustee, now Frost Bank, to be trustee. Now, it's undisputed, Frost Bank is not the trustee yet, and that's the reason the estate has not been distributed. That's the reason Trust 5 has not been funded, because Frost looked at this litigation brought by Mary T. and said, we're not going to accept the appointment until this litigation is over.
So let me clarify that one trust, I guess it's Trust 5, has not been funded, so that really the distribution that would ultimately go into that Trust 5 is still held in the name of the estate.
Yes,
and,
Your Honor.
And monitored or run by the executors of the will.
Yes, just as Josephine intended.
All right, thank
you. They do get to run, and it's not unusual for oil and gas asset estates to be run a little longer or longer than the normal normal estate that's wound up with, you know, it's got CDs and a house and that's all. Now, immediately after, not immediately, but within a year or two after Josephine died, Mary T. started to try to rewrite this will. She had written letters to her mother, said, don't do this, don't do this, don't let the brothers be co-executors, please don't do this. After Josephine died, she started to rewrite the will or try to rewrite the will. And the reason that she wrote the will, and she testified under oath on this, so we don't have to accept counsel's characterization of what she was doing, she admitted the reason. Well, at first, when Mr. Friedman asked her, she said it was a hard question to answer, but finally she said, well, I just thought the wells were too risky. And then if you look in her pleadings, and also in her testimony, she said, I want a right of informed consent on any well that the estate drills. Now, that was completely out of the will. That was not in the will. That was an attempt to rewrite the will. If you look at the second chart, and this is in our brief, set forth carefully, If you look at this chart that was the other handout, Your Honor's clerk, the left-hand column, I'm not going to read this whole thing, but the first two are striking. The left-hand column sets out the powers that Josephine specifically gave her two sons as co-executors, including dealing with any oil and gas or other minerals or mineral rights and royalties, and operating and developing oil, gas, and other mineral properties. She specifically said, you can keep doing this as long as you follow the rest of the terms of the will. Now, what she did, what Mary T. did, is in 2005, in three separate pleadings, and more than just a pleading, but she had a hearing, she expert affidavits, sent out discovery, lawyers had to prepare for and show up at a temporary injunction hearing that ended up getting stopped. But she sued to enjoin them for extraordinary relief to stop them from agreeing to participate in the drilling of any wells, reworking, recompleting, etc. So it was directly contrary to the powers that the estate, the co-executors had thanks to Josephine's will. Now, Your Honor, the case law is clear. These clauses, non-interference clauses, acting contrary to provisions in the will, they are enforced in Texas. There's no question they're enforced. And counsel cited some of those cases. The Hyder case is interesting because this is the same district judge. Judge King is the one that enforced the clause in the Hyder case, and he was affirmed after a transfer to the Dallas Court of Appeals. But as Your Honors know, that is binding precedent on this court. Now, I want to talk a little bit about Mary T's cases. If you look at her cases about what an executor can do or what a beneficiary can do without triggering the clause, and one of her cases has a list of those things, the things that if you look at what she asked for, what she tried to get the district court to do, are not on her list. They're not on the case list at all in terms of the kinds of things that we allow beneficiaries to occasionally try to do. We are not asking she be disinherited for asserting breaches of fiduciary duty. Now, I'm going to get to the grounds of that. I'm going to talk about the lack of any support for those claims in a minute. But assuming that there was some scintilla of evidence to support those claims, she wasn't disinherited for asserting breaches of fiduciary duty. That is a straw man that runs through all of Mary T's briefing. And if you look at the, and I know you will, the judgment and the summary judgment that Judge King signed, he made it clear the reason he was disinheriting her, enforcing Josephine's will, was because of the attempts to tie up and cease oil and gas operations of the estate. And also when she sued to put a receiver in, but not a receiver that would maintain the status quo. Remember, the main assets in this estate were oil and gas assets. And the timing was perfect. Early 2000s, middle 2000s was a great time to be developing these assets. And it wasn't an accident, because Josephine knew what she was doing, that Bill and Ed quadrupled or quintupled the value of the estate and the cash flow in the estate. Now, I want to talk about good faith and probable cause very quickly. There's reference to a statute, but it's uncontested the statute doesn't apply. The statute became effective 7 years after Josephine's death. There is no case, Supreme Court case, that adopts the good faith excuse. None. There are some courts of appeals that have mentioned it, and the Calvert case that Mr. Wright mentioned expressly said, we're not going to adopt this yet. We're not ready to decide whether it is an excuse in Texas as an exception to the overriding guiding light North Star rule in this state that testator's intent is paramount, that it's enforced with only the rarest of rare exceptions. Josephine and her lawyers, though, took the step to take good faith off the table. We've talked about that clause. And we know there was no good faith here because of Mary T's testimony, because she at first couldn't say why she sought to tie up the oil and gas operations of the estate and to prevent the co-executors from doing exactly what the will said. And in fact, when she was asked those questions, Mr. Friedman put the will provisions right in front of her and said, why did you ask for these things when you've admitted this is what the will allows them to do? And at first she said, well, it's a hard question to answer. And then she finally just blurted out, because I thought these were risky wells. Well, the will allows the brothers to make imperfect decisions. It allows them, in fact, says their investments don't have to make a profit. They don't have to generate income. They're allowed to make mistakes in an investment, but very clearly she wanted them to continue the oil and gas operations until Trust 5 could be funded and the trustee accepted the appointment as trustee. As the court found below, her efforts were aimed at shutting down those oil and gas operations. Now, with regard to other items of good faith, the subjective good faith that she claimed to have in her affidavit, she had a sentence in there, and it's the only evidence in the entire record of subjective good faith. The trial court below struck that as broad and conclusory allegation. The other side has not appealed that evidentiary striking. It was the only summary judgment evidentiary ruling he made where he struck evidence. It was the only motion we made. It was very targeted and pointed. He granted it. So the subjective good faith element is completely missing here. Her affidavit does not supply that because it was stricken. And with regard to the lawyer admission, we have to keep in mind that later at a later hearing, after a successor lawyer prior to current counsel was in the case, in a different context, probably not recognizing or realizing what she was admitting, stood up and told the court, "This case is not about mismanagement or imprudent drilling of oil and gas wells." Now let's take a minute and talk about this hypothetical, because that's mostly what we heard from Mr. Wright, is hypotheticals, and I think he even used the word extreme examples. If there was a concern that income from those wells was not going to the correct place, that it was in fact being commingled improperly, or there was some concern about expenses that were getting paid, there were ways to craft an injunction that would say put it in a certain account or report to the court or put it in the deposit of the court. There were ways to actually address any real fiduciary duty concerns if there had been any. That's not what Mary T. was trying to do. And we have her lawyer's admission and then an incredible admission, and we have it only because her expert was part of these discussions. Her expert and then eventually Mary T. and her husband admitted they knew that when their then lawyer, Karen Gordon, filed these injunction claims and set this for hearing and submitted affidavits, they knew there was a chance that she could be disinherited. This isn't an instance where we have an innocent...
Mr. Young.
Yes, Your Honor.
My mind's working a little bit behind where you are right at the moment.
I'm moving pretty quick.
But I'm interested in what example you could give when you say there were or there are other things that might have been done. Wouldn't all of those things that might have been done included litigation, been involved in litigation?
Yes, but we've never contended that the filing of litigation triggers the interim clause or the no interference, prevent any provision.
Well, I'm trying to follow the logic of your statement, being how can you file any kind of litigation that's questioning the actions taken by the co-executors without that being a contest of the what you're contending is the discretion granted in the will to engage in oil and gas matters?
Well, let me give an example. It would not be one type of fiduciary duty claim could be a self-dealing claim.
Okay.
If you made a self-dealing claim and simply made that standing alone and there was some evidence to support it, then you wouldn't trigger any of the...
So the fine line in what you were saying is just merely the type of attack that might have been filed in terms of actions taken by the co-trustees.
Certainly, but that's not a minor distinction, Your Honor.
I didn't mean it to be.
because here it was aimed at shutting down the main assets of the estate and improving the asset value.
I want to conclude.
Have I fully answered your question,
Your Honor?
Yes,
thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. I want to conclude talking some about these accusations against the brothers and show how truly groundless they are. The one about not funding Trust 5 I've talked about. There's no trustee, and it's undisputed case law in Texas is you have to have a trustee to transfer title to for assets held in trust. Until you have a trustee, you can't fund Trust 5. And it's undisputed. Frost has said, while Mary T.'s litigation is ongoing, we're not going to accept this appointment. With regard to the so-called payments or incorrect payments, Suzanne Box testified under oath. This is undisputed. She made those payments, I think it was $2,000 to $3,000, by mistake, on her own, caught the mistake within days. She had hit the wrong account on a drop-down menu, went back, put the money in the back into the estate account on her own. Then and only then did she go to Ed Hudson and say, this is what I did. He said, that's exactly correct, and approved her putting the money back in the estate. And it didn't happen again, and she testified. Am I on red?
You are.
Okay, thank you.
If you can wrap up your...
Thank you. Anyway, she testified that she called the bank and said, make sure this doesn't happen again, change your drop-down menu. That's how diligent these folks were. So for all of these reasons, we ask that Judge King's judgment, summary judgment and judgment below be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Young. Mr. Wright, rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Justice Meyer, you hit on a very good point, because counsel has now conceded that if instead of the injunction Mary T. asked for, she had said, well, please put all proceeds into the registry of the court, that would have been okay. But still, that would have been just as contrary, if you want to say it that way, as to the provisions of the will, which gave the executors the right to control the funds, as what she did. So now they're coming in and saying, well, she should have done it a different way. And now they want to defend their conduct. I believe that if this issue about breach of fiduciary duty is going to be tried, it probably needs to be tried to a jury first rather than try to justify it in the Court of Appeals. Now, a couple of things about the statements about what Josephine knew and what her intent was. Her intent is what's in the will. What she knew because they knew it is not in the record anywhere in terms of coming out of her mouth. But one thing did come out of her mouth, and it's at page 1208 of the record, her first codicil to the will that was apparently holographic and then typed up. No one has disputed the validity of this, although I think it was replaced later. She said she wanted to take out a paragraph about litigation between the heirs, which had been in the first will, a different provision than what we're talking about. So she eliminated that. And she says that it is my understanding that my daughter has filed a lawsuit against my two sons, my grandson and their cousins, which I greatly deplore, but neither I nor my two sons wish for her to be disinherited over this action. That's what Josephine said. That was her intention, and apparently at that time the intention of her sons, although apparently they've changed their mind now, about this idea of Frost Bank won't take it, therefore they can't do anything with it. The second codicil to the will, which is notarized and in the record at page 1071, gives the executors the power to direct the trustee to distribute directly to Mary T. Ard or to put it in the other trust that she already had. And so, you know, yes, Frost has declined because of the litigation. One solution would be for the litigation to get over, okay, by providing the information, by setting a trial, by having these things resolved in the ordinary course. Another way, which they have the power to do, is to tell the trustee, give it directly to Mary T. Ard, or put it in this other trust that was already existing and had a trustee that happened to be Mrs. Ard herself. So we're not trying to rewrite the will. We're trying to at first stop and then recover for any breaches of fiduciary duty. And, you know, the idea that her interest, which is a working interest, has to be, you know, combined with the rest of the estates in order for something to work, that's just not true. And, yes, Mr. Hudson's will had very different provisions about commingling and running these operations, but Josephine's will did not continue that. There are ways to do this if counsel back then advising Josephine wanted to do this, put it in a corporation, put it in another vehicle. But she chose to make these two men fiduciaries for her sister. And they have done nothing in the past 12 years except violate that. That's our allegation, and nobody has even given us a trial on that claim. So, and in terms of the good faith argument, I don't think we need to get there, but this court's decision in the Hammer case says good faith is an exception. Now, nobody pleaded it or proved it in that case, but this court said that. I believe that's something the court ought to take into consideration. And finally, about how oil and gas estates have to be operated in perpetuity, tab C of our brief has a letter from W.A. Hudson to Mary T. Ard or her lawyer in June of 2004. And he says then, we believe we can completely distribute the estate in the next 3 or 4 months. That's what the executor said after taking office over 10 years ago. We believe we can distribute the estate in 3 to 4 months. So the idea that this, that you just can't do anything else, you just have to keep all of this and keep it away from Mary T. and her husband and all these bad things they want to say about them, you know, there is a time and a place to say all of that. And that would be a trial on the merits of this. So again, we urge the court to reverse and hold that Mary T. has not been disinherited in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wright. Thank you, Mr. Young and other counsel. We appreciate all of your briefing and your arguments today. Your case is now submitted and you are excused.